Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2012. Lecture 7, delivered on February 7, 2012. The title of this lecture is Review of Accounting.
Today, Review of Accounting. Now, I make jokes about accounting. I shouldn't do that. Are you an accounting major? Good, okay. Why do accountants walk in threes, groups of three? Well, one reads, one writes, and the other keeps an eye on the two intellectuals. You got a busload of accountants. It's half full, the bus is. What do you got? A waste of bus seats. No, I shouldn't do that. Understand that accounting is at the core of civilization, as strange as that may seem. Our entire civilization, in some ways, is actually based upon early accounting. You see, back in the earliest times when there was commerce, there were essentially what you might call landowners who had herds large enough that they would be able to trade animals for other things that they needed. The basis of commerce. You specialize in what you do best, most efficiently, let others do the same, and then you trade what you need of something that you're not producing. So some of these large landowners with large herds of animals began to have their animals taken to market, oftentimes a trusted relative, servant, something along that line would take some of the animals to market and then get something in exchange for that and bring it back to the estate of the landowner. We're talking about many thousands of years ago. And what they would do is oftentimes the owners of the animals, they would send the servant, the trusted servant, to the markets far away with a jar, and in the jar, clay jar, would be little shapes made of clay, of somewhat burnished clay, glazed clay. You might have some things that were shaped like cones that would be sheep, and maybe some things that were more like rods that would be cattle or something like that. And they would put, okay, I am sending with this person to the market three cattle and five sheep. And they would put these little toys in the jar and they would seal the jar up. And then when the servant got to the marketplace, the traders there would verify that he had the number of animals he was sent with by smashing the clay pot and then counting what was in it. That way it was like a secure, almost like their version of an encrypted system, so that they knew that this was an honest servant who had not sold animals along the way or slaughtered something to eat along the way. Now, ultimately, what happened was that somewhere along the line, they got the idea, okay, we're going to, just to make it a little bit more obvious what's going on in this clay pot, we're going to, before we glaze the pot, we're going to press each of these figures, these little toy things, onto the surface of it so that you can see on the outside what's on the inside. And then that sort of gives you a double proof of what's going on in the pot, inside the clay pot. Well, eventually this whole system kind of fell apart because it was, why do this if all we really have to send to the market is a clay tablet with these impressions on it? And this would indicate sheep and the number of them. And this would indicate cattle and the number of them. And we might even be able, over a period of time, to add a few more symbols to indicate the whether they're young or old. Maybe press a little dot here for calf. And over here with the sheep, a couple of dots if it is a female, or no dot if it's a male. And ultimately, that was where the first writing came from, called cuneiform. It's written in the clay tablets. Our writing, Western civilization's writing, began with an accounting tablet, for God's sake. The entire basis of writing was nothing, started as a commerce document for accounting purposes in commerce. That's where it all came from. So at the heart of everything that is Western civilization as far as literature is accounting, which is rather disturbing when you think about it. But here's how it goes. Accounting was used all through the ages. We use accounting information for all kinds of purposes for understanding history. In my alternate life, one of my alternate lives, I was a medieval scholar. And in the Middle Ages, in England and in Europe, kings took censuses to determine how much land, how many animals, how much grain, all that kind of stuff the nobles had on the land of England, for example. And that information was collected into these massive books that were compiled every decade or every once in a while. We can read through those and we can see the accounting. This lord has this many hides of land. Hide was their acre. Has this kind of stuff on it, all this kind of stuff. Oh, he has this many cattle. See, the kings want to know this because then they could predict their tax base. They could also, and all that kind of stuff. So there again, and then we can look through this stuff. We can tell a whole lot about what was going on in medieval Europe just by reading these stupid accounting census documents. In fact, I talk about that when I teach economics, how hugely important it is to our understanding of not just the economics of the time, but the social mores of the time and even weather in the time. Take you to the Renaissance period. Accounting was more or less not standardized at all. You would have these censuses from one period to the next. They might change the way they kept account of things. In fact, in different parts of England, the measure of a plot of land could be use a slightly different metric. They all use the word hide, H-I-D-E, which was sort of like an acre, not an acre, but it was different for different parts of England. So there wasn't a standardized representation of accounting information at all. You get out of the Middle Ages and you get into the Renaissance. And in Italy, there was a monk, one of those guys that had the shaved top on his head, sits most of his day praying or doing something like that. This monk's name was Pacioli. And Mr. Pacioli invented an accounting system. Specifically, he developed a double entry accounting system in which there would be a matching. Okay, every transaction is actually two things happening. That was how he saw it. Well, okay, when you get cash, that's not the only thing that happens. Something goes out with the cash. You got cash because you gave up something. You get one asset by giving up another asset. You get a liability, you get an asset by incurring a liability. And it was remarkable genius to see this. Everything that we do commercially is actually two things at once. And unless we recognize both things at once, we're going to miss half of the picture of a commercial transaction. And we're going to completely ignore half of a business's activity. It was brilliant in its own, you know, rather pedantic way. And it was very quickly embraced. Not just in Italy, but all through Europe. It just, this Pacioli system spread rapidly. And businesses adopted it very quickly. Here's why. If everyone was doing their numbers the same way, then when a business person went to a king or a tyrant or a wealthy merchant or a banker or to a rich family, that the lender, the potential investor or the lender, would be able to see the numbers and know that they were consistent with other possible investments or loans that could be made. And in that way, the wealthy, and I'll give you an example, in Italy, the Medicis. You want us to invest in your business, or you want us to give you a loan? Well, then you had better come to us with Pacioli system documents, so that we can look at your business and we can understand the sources and uses of cash. We can understand your income statement. We can understand the balance sheet. It was crude back then, those instruments, but it was surprisingly close to what we have today, but there was still some crudeness to it. But you see, this induced a couple of things. First of all, businesses got uniform in the representations of how transactions happen. And it made investors much more comfortable with making business investments. In many ways, and I might overstate this, but in many ways, a double entry accounting system, the Pacioli system, pretty much what you learn in your accounting courses, it was what propelled us out of the Middle Ages / Renaissance haphazard investment strategies and structures that were going on into a tight, commercial, rigid, highly efficient system that drove us into the Industrial Revolution. We could then, merchants were rather wealthy people, the Medici family, was comfortable with making an investment in exploration of a new territory in the new worlds. The investors in the Medici family especially were comfortable with making investments in art museums and putting money into artists' pockets because they could then understand how the sources and uses of cash were going on with these artisans, these musicians. Literally, in many ways, those families in Italy were driving the arts and arts of the time and created much of what we consider to be high civilization in our time now. We can look back on those paintings, on those musical works, and we know, oh my God, those were paid for by the rich people of the time who saw them not as dalliances, but as investments. And those investments were backed by documentation that was uniform and according to standards that everyone knew and everyone abided by in the time. Now, we have in our country today, and across much of the world, similar things, generally accepted accounting standards, GAAS. Now, in practice, those are the generally accepted accounting principles that are used by businesses to represent transactions in documented, known, and standardized ways. Then the auditors can look at those statements and say that they were done in compliance with these generally accepted accounting principles. And we know that whether or not they are correct or not, they were done according to the rules. The truth of the matter is that the entire system is on the brink of collapse. Everyone knows that it just can't accommodate what is going on in the world today. It just can't. Across countries, across products, across all of the complexity of transactions, it's getting to the point where it is just madness. Even with relatively straightforward transactions, trying to understand what is the accepted principle for it can be a real pain in the ass. But what are we going to do about it? The FASB, the Financial Accounting Standards Board, it's It's got a turf. It's just going to keep writing rules for one transaction after another. Oh, this is new. Here's a rule for it. Oh, this has changed. Here's a new rule. It will just keep piling it on until some external body, the United Nations, maybe, I doubt it, but perhaps Congress says, we've got to do this again. We've got to figure out a more global system and some kind of a system that, although extraordinarily complex, is doable for the 21st century. Are we anywhere near that now? Hell no. Just new rules all the time to try to accommodate all the complex transactions. Enough about that. Here's the bottom line. Finance, we use accounting data. And I've said this lecture before. We have to recognize, though, that in finance, that accounting data is telling us a story through a glass darkly. Because accounting information is an information product for consumers of information about companies. It must follow rules, and those rules have to be strict and rigid, particularly with respect to reference. In a business, I can't say, well, I spent 10 hours of my own time, I could have been making $20 an hour. So I recognize an expense of $20. I can't do that in accounting. I have to have a receipt. I have to have proof, documentation, that this is an expense that happened. So accounting, first of all, deals only in direct costs. In finance, we have to look at all costs, what we call economic costs. We have to look primarily at direct costs, yes, but the much more prevalent, powerful opportunity cost. Direct cost is money out of your pocket. Opportunity cost is money that did not go into your pocket. So whereas the direct cost of a project might be $10,000, if you add an opportunity cost of what you could have done instead, you could have made money doing something else with your life, the cost of the project becomes staggering. And whereas if you look at just the accounting cost, you would say, yes, it's a profitable project. If you look at all the costs, including opportunity costs, the hidden costs, the indirect costs, you'd say, absolutely not, no way. And I have seen business after business make the mistake of ignoring opportunity cost completely. And I might have already told you this one, but a great, great example of it was here in this fine part of area of the center of the state. There was a dream about, it was all 10 years ago, the mayor of the big city, right next to this one, had this idea. She wanted to let her legacy to be an entertainment arena, a sports venue, entertainment venue, right here in this city, dreaming as she was that that would make this like a nexus of the state, of the center of the state. So when I was teaching at a private school, a private college, not far from here, I won't mention its name. I'm not teaching there anymore. They thought I was a creep. I had my finance students, very well behaved. I mean, they were all virgins, I think, and they were all, none of them drank. And I mean, I'm not even sure if they even took a shit. They were really good, nice kids. They really well behaved. And I said, we're going to listen to the mayor of the city speak to us tonight about her dream project, this arena. And so we went there, and my students sat there very patiently, very politely. She came in, and she had her city manager, the finance boy, with her. Now, he was on a leash she had tied to him, and it was almost like, come on, boy, come on, here, sit. Tell him about the finances. And my finance students sat and listened very patiently. He went through the costs of the project, putting up the building, the giant building, and the parking lot, and all of that. And he did a good job. He was a nice guy. very weeny guy, as I recall. At the end of it, he said, "Do you have any questions?" And of course, you could hear the crickets chirp. My students wanted to go home and do their thing, drink milk and eat cookies or whatever the hell they did, until they got to the sorority house and then tore up like hell and denied that they did things like that. But none of them said anything, and so I thought, well, I got to break the ice here. So I raised my hand. I said, "I'm looking through your costs here. Where's the cost of the land?" And he said, "Oh, well, we own the land." You own the land. So that's not a cost of the project, is it? He was a finance major, and I believe he was a finance major from here. And at the time, he knew very well that he should probably take a shit, because what he had done is he was playing it just as he was supposed to. It was a positive net present value project because things like the cost of the land weren't in there. I own the land, so that's not a cost of the project. Like hell, it's not a cost of the project. You could have sold the land. You could do something else with the land. Yes, it is a cost of this project. Yes, all the police who are going to be on duty here are going to be a cost of the project. Yes, all of the equipment the city has that is going to be used for this project is a cost of the project. No, it's not that you own it, so it's not a cost. Of course it's a cost. In finance terms, which matter most to us, it is a cost whether you own it or buy it. It's a cost of the project. It was just riddled with a complete absence of all the indirect costs. And I let him off the hook because I was afraid he'd be beaten later or something like that. But here's the thing is that in accounting, well, also, by the way, I mean, the analysis, and we're going to get into project analysis, so I might as well point this out here. Not only were the costs accounting costs, not economic costs, that made it look more favorable, but also when you're doing revenue, it's so easy to swear, this thing's going to sell like hotcakes. I remember several times as a consultant, I would ask company people when we were getting started on a company, what's your target market? And God, I hate it when they said, "Well, everybody, like hell, everybody's going to buy your product. Give me a sector. Give me a target. Not everybody in the world's going to buy your product." They on the revenue side for this venue, they said, "All right, here's Bloomington." Who am I kidding? Here's Bloomington. And we're going to, our market's going to be 60-mile radius of people who want to see sports. Okay, what's within 60 miles of that little dot there called Bloomington? How about the Peoria Civic Center? Yeah. No, you're not going to sell like hotcakes to every farm prairie hillbilly in 60 miles. They'll go over to Peoria and listen to the rodeo. Watch the rodeo. God. Okay. What's the upshot of this? The latest revenue estimates put the arena at a deficit for the last year of $6.1 million. Well, who would have possibly thunk that? Spank me, Jesus. We've been losing money every year. Yes, because you did not get honest at the beginning and see that accounting costs are not all of the costs. And revenue is not a fantasy. It will bite you in the ass when those dollars are not as thick in that cash drawer as you thought they would be. So accounting deals in direct costs. We have to deal with that. The other critical problem we have in finance is that accounting data is historical. Historical. In other words, in accounting, what you see is what already happened. What already happened is not what is going to be your driving decision-making force. It's what you expect to happen next. If what already happened to you was driving your life, most of you would probably kill yourselves. Because you would think back, all right, high school, I got swirlies. Grade school, yep, more swirlies. When I was growing up, my parents were jerks. Yeah, life sucks. I might as well kill myself. That or just go emo and pierce my ass. You're alive because you're looking at your future. It's bright. All of you, well, most of you, are going to go out and make a lot of money. You're going to have a great life. You're going to get some butt. You're going to make money. You're going to eat well. You're going to drive nice cars. You're going to have some toys. And a few of you might even rise to positions of significant power and influence. That's what's driving you to be here, not what's happened to you. If what happened to you mattered, you'd be worshiping at the toilet of the Grand Swirly. You're investing in college for the future. You're not investing in it for the past. Well, I want to make my life in high school right, show everyone that I could have done it. Bullshit. You're here so that you can have a great future. You see, accounting data is historical data. That doesn't mean it's useless, worthless. It's, again, we're looking at it through a glass darkly. We need to see what happens next. History can give us some guides in many cases, but it can't tell us the future. And that's what we have to do in finance. We have to see what the expected future cash flows are from a project, not what's already happened. So know that and put it personally in your lives. When you think about projections, what is this going to be a good project or not? Don't think about history. You're not in college because of history. You're in college because of the possibility of a good future. Okay, here's another one. And I'm picking on accounting. Don't get me wrong. I'm trying to lay out why in finance we have to be careful when we use accounting data. There's another thing about accounting data that is a little that we have to be careful about. We have the thing about the direct costs instead of all costs, economic costs. We have the historical data problem. And then just as a third one here, how would I put this? I'm not sure. I hate to say it this way. Phantom expenses. I say this too many times, and I know I'm going to get my ass kicked by someone in accounting for saying this, but it's true. Phantom expenses. That doesn't mean they're dirty or illegal or immoral or you're trying to lie. Absolutely not. But here's the deal. You've had your first accounting course, have you? Is that correct? Do you remember doing depreciation, straight line, double declining balance, MACRS, all that kind of stuff? You remember depreciation? And it's right there in the income statement in the cost, depreciation, X dollars. Do you remember that? You know what? You will never write a company check to someone called depreciation. You will never do it. It won't happen to you. It's just not going to happen. There is no such thing in the real world as depreciation in a cost sense. There's economic depreciation, the actual physical erosion of buildings and machinery over time. There's no question about that. But as far as depreciation as an expense, it ain't there. And yet there it is on the income statement. So we have to add in those, back in those phantom costs. Because in accounting, you recognize expenses in very different ways from how they happen in the real world. Okay. You, sir, are about to pay your tuition, then you're going to go out for a meal, and then you're possibly even going to be able to have enough money so that you can have a friend for a few hours. Yeah, you'll have enough money for that, I think. Okay, now, you've got $12,000 in your pocket, okay? Now, I come along, I am an alien mothership, okay? Yeah, many people have called me mother, okay? And I float up to you, and I have this tractor beam, and I take that $12,000, and I pull it right out of your pocket. And I'm starting to fly away. You scream at me, "My money!" And I look back at you and I lean out, "Son, yes, I just took $12,000 from you, but..." Are you an accounting major? Okay. Here's an accounting lesson. Straight line depreciated. So I, over 12 years, so I really took only $1,000 a year out of your pocket. Okay? Now, don't you feel better? I really took only $1,000 out of your pocket each year for the next 12 years. Now, you're thinking, what the hell does that have to do with anything? You understand that's how depreciation works. You actually spend a huge amount of money on a capital expenditure, but you can't recognize all of it immediately. You have to break that up year after year after year. Financial reality is that money just went out the door. It's with Jesus now. But in accounting terms, it's still, most of it's with you, and it just slowly disappears over a period of years. Do you see the problem? How that, if we don't recognize the reality, you don't recognize the reality that you have lost all your money now. You're going to do things really badly because you'll think that you can still spend $11,000 because you depreciated only $1,000 of it. See the problem, okay? You follow with me? That's why it's important in finance for us to not look at these structured ways. They have to do it in accounting the way they do. You don't. Now, what I'm going to do here is I'm going to do the rest of this on Thursday. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.